as interactive as possible.
Please, if you have any questions, interrupt me, and I'd like to address them, okay? Today I'm going to give you bottom line of lipids. Not treatment, that will be a second lecture, but I'll talk about pathophysiology of lipid disorders. So, the reason why we're interested in lipid, of course, is because of the atherogenic lesions. Here you see a vulnerable plaque, and there it's a clot, and you all know what that means. So I will talk about physiology of lipids and lipoproteins, and then some of the common or less common lipid disorders that you should be familiar with. Okay, plasma lipoproteins. Number one, you're all familiar with the concept why lipids don't float in the water soluble medium like blood, not impossible. So therefore, there are lipid phospholipid bilayer enclosed vesicles that carry lipids from the liver or from the intestine to target cells and back and so on. And there are receptors that allow exchange of lipids at different target sites and interaction with enzymes and so on. Alright? So, what we really want to know when we assess a patient, we want to know where do lipids go? What is the fluxes? And unfortunately, we cannot do that. But what we can do, we can measure the steady state levels of lipoproteins. And so we need to know a little bit of what they are. So the chylomicrons, the ones that are generated from the intestine, that have mostly triglycerides, 86%, they have all the lipoproteins have some phospholipid, as you can see, and they have some proteins based on the associated lipoproteins, but no, the yellow is cholesterol, and you see the chylomicrons have little cholesterol, then the very low density lipoprotein has about 20% cholesterol, LDL has about 50% cholesterol, and HDL has 22%. These are rough measures, but this is important to keep in mind that this is only 5% cholesterol. Here you have 50% cholesterol, and here we are 20%. For the calculations that we use to assess LDL, for example, we assume that there's only VLDL in the sample, and that make a big difference if the patient has eaten. If you get a lipid profile, the patient has eaten, the triglycerides containing particles are only 5% in cholesterol. Therefore, it's not valid to calculate cholesterol. We get into this in more detail than me. Simple way to assess lipids is to take a anticoagulated plasma serum or serum. Or you can also use serum or plasma. Let it sit upright overnight in the refrigerator and look at the next morning. On the left, you have a normal sample, so you have some slight turbidity. If you have VLDL, then you have more turbidity. And if you have chylomicrons, they float to the top, you have a cake on top. So this is a sample with extreme hyperlipidemia, where you have markedly increased chylomicrons as well as VLDL. If this was like this, then you would say it's strictly chylomicron. So you can look at that and know what you have. It's very useful. You only do this in patients with extreme hyperlipidemia. So let's talk about, if you remember, two principal pathways for lipids and lipoprotein generation and metabolism. One is the exogenous pathway. It's derived from lipids taken in through the intestinal tract, and that's shown here. So when you eat fat, what happens in the intestinal wall, the flesh borders break down fat to the individual components, and they take up the individual components into the cell through transporters and assemble in the endothelial cell
kind of microbes.
We synthesize lipids, triglycerides, and package them into these lipid vesicles that also contain some apoproteins. And in this case, it's ApoB48. It's a smaller version of the edited transcript of the ApoB100, of the ApoB encoding gene. ApoB48 is characteristic for chylomicrons. ApoE is also present. And then they also have C2 and C3, which is not shown. So what can happen to these chylomicrons? They get into the bloodstream, from the lymph into the bloodstream, and then as they hit the epithelial, go through the epithelium within the blood vessels, they will be exposed to lipoprotein lipase, which requires as a coactivator for protein C2, and that will result in the generation of free fatty acids, and they can be taken up by various tissues for energy. And they can also actually bound to albumin in the plasma, and that is one of the problems of insulin resistance. Right now we'll talk about the basic mechanism. So when these chylomicrons are depleted of their triglycerides by this mechanism, then they end up as remnants, and the remnants can be taken up by the liver and reutilized. So that's the nutshell, the exogenous pathway. The endogenous pathway, not just
comes into play when we don't eat. We have nothing in the intestine. Now, it's not clear cut. The endogenous and exogenous pathways go on at the same time to some degree. Of course, if there's nothing in the intestinal lumen, then there is only the endogenous pathway in play. The endogenous pathway is primarily directed from the liver in the production of very low density lipoprotein.
So the liver assembles this lipoprotein particle with triglycerides and cholesterol esters in the core, phospholipid bilayer, and then you have ApoB100 as the major apoprotein, and also ApoE, ApoC2, ApoC3, and so on. Again, this particle is also then subject to lipoprotein lipase and can generate free fatty acids for fuel and for storage of fat cells. And then you end up with a remnant that still has ApoE and ApoB100, which means it has a high affinity for the LDL receptor in the liver and can bind to the LDL receptor. Go back to the liver, and what escapes that process ends up as LDL. If the particles lose the ApoE, then the affinity for the LDL receptor drops down dramatically, whereas the remnant particles have a half-life of 20 minutes or something like this. LDL has a half-life
of days, circulates for days,
because as ApoE is lost, this particle only has ApoB, and therefore
the affinity for the LDL receptor is markedly reduced.
That accounts for the primary role of LDL in atherogenesis,
because it's a major lipoprotein particle that circulates for the longest.
So this just reiterates the basic pathway of the liver for the production of 100 of C's. We talk about those in a little bit. ApoE, you can have lipolysis in remnant, get back to the liver, or if you then lose ApoE, you end up with LDL. LDL can go back to the liver, go to peripheral sites,
go to atheroma, to endothelial
walls and so on, and the liver cholesterol and set up the process of atherosclerosis. there's a little bit more detail about these things. So this looks primarily now at cholesterol. Cholesterol comes in together with triglycerides in the diet. There are specific transporters in the intestinal wall that allow cholesterol to come in, and some come back.
Toxic sterols like plant sterols,
that's very important also. So you end up with chylomicrons in this case. Chylomicrons that enter the bloodstream, they can give up free fatty acids and go become remnants and taken up by the liver through the scavenger receptor B1. The LDL stems from the VLDL that is produced here, and then also gets depleted of triglycerides by lipoprotein lipase. Get remnants that can go back to the liver, but those that do escape become LDL, and they can eventually be taken up to the LDL receptor. As I told you, this is a much less effective, less efficient process than this. The LDL receptors, of course, are also present in the liver, so we can deliver cholesterol to the peripheral cells. So needed membrane function and so on, and a few of those also don't need. So I'm going to now get into the different entities. So we have genetic disorders, and we have acquired disorders of lipoprotein metabolism. The one that set off the whole discovery of LDL receptors, so it's familial hyperphosphatemia. It's a very uncommon disease, but it has given rise to the discovery by Ronald Goldstein of the LDL receptor, and I've coated bits of a lot of concepts that are extremely important. Just to give you an idea what the levels are, if you have homozygous FH, your level is 650. This is a mistake, even though this is published in the New England Journal. Homozygous is 650 milligrams, whereas heterozygous is about 300. Familial ligand defective, upper B100, is where the upper B100 is missing, and therefore can bind to the LDL receptor. It's a phenocopy of FH. We'll talk a little bit more about this, and therefore the levels are about the same. It's somewhat different here, but I'm not so sure that that's true. Autosomal recessive hypercholesterolemia is where you have the LDL receptor there, but its activity is not working. So it's also very similar. Citrosterolemia is a disease where you miss the transporters that drive toxic plant sterols back into the gut. If those are genetically defective, then these build up and cause toxic effects. So let's talk about FH. Autosomal dominant inheritance. It's due to LDL receptor deficiency, as we know. It's very uncommon. Homozygous 1 in a million,
heterozygous 1 in 500.
LDL cholesterol is increased, of course. In heterozygous about twice, and homozygous 4 to 6 times. And the familial defective ApoB, where you have
a mutation in the gene encoding the ApoB, which is unable to bind to the receptor,
you have a phenocopy of the same disease, basically. These are very rare diseases, but they can be extremely helpful in the study of any of the concepts. So what's wrong in FH, of course, or so the LDL receptor is missing or defective, and therefore you can't bind. So you build up LDL and remnants. Everything can go easily to LDL, so you end up with lots of LDL.
So what are the clinical manifestations of FH?
Some of them
look for. Some heterozygotes you can see some you're more subtle.
So somebody who has a high triglycerides, greater than 250, LDL.
So they've increased, obviously, after chronic vascular disease, the homozygotes die as teenagers if they don't have heart attacks, if they don't get treated recently, early. The heterozygotes get their heart attacks somewhat later, but they have a high, also markedly increased incidence, of course. Premature coronary heart disease. What are the findings that we see? Xanthelasma, corneal arcus in young people. In elderly people, corneal arcus means nothing. Tendon xanthomas, they can have arthritic type pain in the joints. It's very non-specific, it's not too helpful. And they have a strong family history because it's always on the dominant transmission. Here's an arcus that you all have seen. If it occurs in a young person, you really have to worry. Xanthelasmas look like this. And positions of lipids in the skin around the eye, why they occur there, nobody has any idea. And the tendon xanthomas are most common. This is a very dramatic case. Sometimes you just see thickening of the tendon of your arteries. That's almost pathognomonic for FH. Can you see the heterozygous FH? This lumpy is a very, very extreme case, but can be seen like this, of course. And if you have the defective upper bleed, then you have a different copy of the disease, so it makes perfect sense. Much more common. The familial entity is a so-called familial combined hyperlipidemia, which you have frequency of 1 in 100 instead of 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in 500 for the heterozygous FH. It's also autosomal dominant. The lipoprotein pattern depends on the diet and also its variability within family members. Both phenotypes, based on the old Fredrickson character classification, and the pathophysiology is that there's overproduction of LP100, namely overproduction of VLDL, and that results in increased cardiovascular risk also. So you have overproduction of VLDL, and that leads to overproduction of remnants and LDL, because driving force is increased. Okay? And the phenotypes can vary depending on the diet and so on. Then you have, they will have very characteristic classical clinical findings in terms of skin findings or eye findings and so on. Familial combined. This is another very rare one, familial type 1. This is it's also 1 in 1,000,000, it's recessively inherited, and the triglycerides are typically greater than 1,000, I've seen as much as 6,000, 8,000. Present in childhood, especially puberty girls, and pathophysiology here is the absence of lipoprotein lipase or APOC2. So lipoprotein lipase is an enzyme that breaks down triglycerides in both chylomicrons and LDL. And APOC2 is the apolipoprotein that's the cofactor required for activation of lipoprotein lipase. So if you have a gene defect in lipoprotein lipase, if you have no lipoprotein lipase, okay. Digest the triglycerides, and if you have the cofactor C2, then you get the same field. These patients typically get pancreatitis and xanthomas, but different from the FH, they get eruptive xanthomas, I'll show you. And
they can get hepatosplenomegaly because of the position of the solids in the stain. So the problem here is that you have a block here, either due to defective LPL or defective missing C2. So you don't get LDL accumulation or remnants. What you get is both the ischemic ones and the LDL ones. This is what eruptive sarcomas look like.
And what they are, they almost in some cases look like pustules. They look like pustules, but they actually
have the position of lipids in the skin with the reaction.
Here you have a discrimination mark, but these are lipid deposition. They typically occur on
the surfaces of the extremities. They usually require the triglycerides to be way above 1,000. You don't see them unless triglycerides are way above 1,000. Also pancreas, like a you don't see unless it's way above 1,000. I've seen a patient with this disease present one time just with eruptive sarcomas, another time just with pancreatitis, and all the areas. Lipemia retinitis.
So you can make the diagnosis at the bedside with a thermoscope. You look into the eyes and you see lipid streaks in the vessels in the retina.
Because it's so lipemic,
the serum plasma so lipemic that you can see it in the on thermoscopic examination. It's called lipemia retinitis.
So another also uncommon disease is lenalidomide removal disease. Actually, I've never seen a case, but they have also some characteristic features. It's also called type 3 hyperlipidemia or broad beta disease because of the broad beta on lipid electrophoresis, lipoprotein electrophoresis. It's uncommon, requires the allele E2, both E2, homozygous E2, and a second defect, actually, expression. So this is actually quite common, 1 in 100, but you need a second genetic defect to get the disease, and the pathophysiology is impaired clearance of ApoB E remnants by the remnant receptor. In other words, allele E2 has a low affinity together with ApoB for the remnant receptor. So therefore you have delayed or retarded clearance of remnants. So both chylomicron and ELDL remnants accumulate, and the diagnosis is made by broad band on a lipoprotein electrophoresis. You can also look at the VLDL cholesterol to triglyceride ratio, but we won't go into specifics about how to do this now. Let's just tell you that this is also associated with increased cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease, and the hallmarks of this disease are skin manifestations, palmar and tubular eruptive sarcomas. So not the tendon sarcomas, not the eruptive sarcomas, the tubular eruptive. So what the hell, we get to that. So the problem here is that the E2 allele homozygous here, together with some other genetic effects, so you have impaired remnant clearance, remnant removal, and therefore you get buildup. This doesn't come out very well. There's some sarcomas, but this is very clear. This is tuberous eruptive sarcomas. So this is an elbow. You can see the tuberous mass-like accumulations of
lipids on the skin, and then some eruptive cytosis at the same time. This is classical for the broadband disease. Okay, let's review more descriptive here with some nice pictures. So let's look at dietary fats. So cholesterol
gets in through the transporter here, and I told you about the MCG5 and G8 that need to bring the toxic sterols back into the intestinal lumen and not allow them to accumulate. If you have a genetic defect here, you get cytostatic anemia. The only way the body can get rid of it is liver produces VLDL, the other, as we said, that can be treated of triglycerides and ultimately end up as a remnant and go back to the liver, or as LDL particles. So if you have genetic defects, then you get also what it says in hypercholesterolemia, familial ligand effect, FH. This is just a sort of a reiteration of what I told you before. So, we have somebody with an elevated cholesterol level. We want to classify them into hereditary and familial and non-familial entities. So, elevated LDL is defined as greater than 160 in a otherwise normal person. And if you apply that, a quarter of all Americans has primary hypercholesterolemia. A quarter. So just count where this is. Familial hypercholesterolemia comes from a few of these, familial combined, and polygenic is the vast majority. We don't know the multiple genes that contribute to the output of the production and clearance of the genes that are not clearly identified. Polygenic genetic in many patients. People, and so one quarter of all the patients have polygenic hypercholesterolemia. Now, diet can raise your cholesterol, and what it does is it has several effects. If you have increased caloric intake, you get overproduction of VLDL triglycerides. Therefore, more VLDL is produced, more remnants are produced. The ones, but the take up of the remnants by the remnant receptor in the liver is somewhat impaired in by saturated fat and cholesterol in the diet. And so, therefore, more remnants escape and turn into LDL, and the LDL clearance is also impaired through that same mechanism. So, you get more remnants and more LDL. So dietary caloric excess and fat can raise lipids. So let's talk a little bit about HDL. That's not so straightforward, more complicated. And less understood, less well understood. The main concept that's being thrown around and that is very highly favored as is not. There's pretty good evidence that the process exists, but exactly how it works is not completely understood. It's called reverse cholesterol transport. How does cholesterol ester that's stored in cells, such as macrophages, how does it get back out of there? There is a mechanism, it's called reverse cholesterol transport. And what it requires is, number one, that the cholesterol ester is converted to free cholesterol in the cell, because cholesterol ester can't get out. It's very, like, very hydrophobic.
frequent stores can get out through a transporter. ABCA1 is an ATP binding cassette transporter. A1 is a specific transporter here that allows free cholesterol to come out of cells if there's an acceptor there that can pick it up. Because cholesterol is all in the plasma. So if you have a nascent HDL particle that has ApoE1, it can take up this phospholipid. With ApoE1, it allows the transfer of free cholesterol into this particle and generation of mature HDL. And HDL gets mature by converting free cholesterol to cholesterol esters, which requires this enzyme, lecithin cholesterol isotransferase. Cholesterol will distribute in the membrane of the body. It doesn't go to the core because it's ambivalent. So therefore, in order for the card particle to grow, it has to make the cholesterol nonpolar, so put it in the core and grow. And the way to do that is to esterify it, and then you have cholesterol esters that are nonpolar, like you said, move it to the core of the particle, and cholesterol, free cholesterol, remains in the surface of the particle. So mature HDL is the major particle that is thought to allow this reverse cholesterol transfer. There's a scavenger receptor in the liver that allows uptake and of this particle and reuptake of cholesterol and esters further metabolism. That's the main concept of reverse cholesterol transport. But it becomes more complicated if you take into account another player, which is called cholesterol ester transfer protein. So it's not all going here, but there is actually part of this cholesterol ester from HDL can be exchanged against triglycerides with LDL and VLDL. And then this can be taken, so this would be the indirect reverse cholesterol transport. This would be the direct one, this would be indirect. The LDL and VLDL particles, or as remnants, can then be taken up by the liver to the LDL. Why this is there, we don't know, and the exact role of this is not known. People that have mutations in this will have increased, somewhat defective CETP will have increased HDL levels. Increased HDL levels. They have a defective CETP. And it's been shown by a group here at Einstein to be associated with longevity in Ashkenazi Jews. And there's a lot of interest in developing drugs to inhibit CETP to mimic this kind of genetic defect. Fortunately, the first drug that was developed by Pfizer, called Tocet Rapid, went through clinical trials, showed tremendous increase in HDL, much more than any other known medication. And clinical trials showed that this increased cardiovascular risk, increased death cardiovascular risk. And to finagle this now to say that the drug also caused elevation in blood pressure and that probably offset the benefit. It's not known what the reason is. But the first drug tried on this is now has been completely discontinued by Pfizer. It's a complete bust. But, CETP inhibitor. But several other drug companies are still working on CETP inhibitors and are hoping that restraining this process will accelerate reverse cholesterol transport. But you should be familiar with this just for that reason, because these kind of drugs will probably come on the market if they work and if they're safe. Just a little bit more nicely to see how all this actually works. Where does Apple actually work? Either the enterocyte or the
able to live with it as best it can be.
And then that associates with phospholipid vesicles, and then it picks up free cholesterol, and then it picks up more free cholesterol from peripheral cells, and through LCAT it can then convert it to cholesterol esters and mature into cholesterol tablets. The ones from the liver are a little bit different from the ones that that's not the relevance for this upper A2 model. It's not really known whether clinical is important or not. But we can distinguish between upper A1 and upper A2 containing particles by certain techniques. And the macrophage, shown in some more detail here, is a cartoon. Has, as I told you before, this ABCA1 membrane transporter that can move free cholesterol into the particles of ABCA1. But there's actually a second transporter that also plays a role, and that can only transport it into already mature tissue. So things are a little more complicated than what meets the eye initially. As you know, the macrophage is one of the key things for atherosclerosis. And why is because they have this scavenger receptor B1, which can give up some cholesterol to mature HDL particles, but it's also a receptor for oxidized LDL. It leads to the formation of foam cells and engorgement of macrophages with cholesterol esters. The problem is, whereas the LDL receptor, which is present in all cells, is regulated. If the cell has too much cholesterol, it downregulates the expression of the LDL, so it takes more LDL up. Whereas the scavenger receptor, so there's lots of LDL around, especially if it circulates a long time, it gets oxidized and gets taken up. It's scavenger receptor, which is the foam cells burst. And here's just a way to how this reverse cholesterol transfer goes to the liver. So there are two ways. It can go directly from HDL to the also scavenger receptor to the liver and gets then either utilized for VLDL production and so on, and but it can be excreted into the bile as free cholesterol or converted to bile acid, excreted to the bile as bile acid. So this is the way reverse cholesterol works. Whereas indirect, that's what is when cholesterol ester gets transferred to VLDL or LDL particles, and they can then ultimately go through the LDL receptor into the cholesterol. All right. Secondary causes of low HDL. Because in general, HDL is a marker, is a protective marker. LDL is a risk marker, and HDL is considered in general a marker, a protective marker. Although it doesn't have to be an HDL particle can get rid of its content because, there's a, for example, the receptor for taking up HDL in the liver, that receptor is defective. HDL, you have high HDL, and yet you have increased cardiovascular risk because you can't unload it. So, the problem with our approach to patients is that you only have just things that happen, you don't really know what's happening, you have things to go into. That's what we like. So, you have to keep in mind that HDL in general is a good thing, but there are some exceptions to the condition. So, what lowers HDL up? Smoking, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, high carb and a very low fat diet,
hypertriglyceridemia, drugs. Drugs have a minor effect. All this can play some role, and we see a lot of this. Dyslipidemia. So what are the cholesterol disorders associated with premature coronary artery disease? They're the familiar ones, and they are the triglyceride disorders also. So we have familial FH and the various forms I told you about. Nephritic syndrome is a typical one. It's LDL, metabolism. Lipoprotein little a, I didn't say anything about it yet.
It's another lipoprotein that is associated with LDL, with lipoprotein particles.
We now know that genetic studies recently published in the New England Journal in December that we have a genetic defect that pairs metabolism of lipoprotein little a. If you have an elevated lipoprotein little a, it's cardiovascular.
It's clearly now established, and
at some point it probably will have to be incorporated into the risk assessment, depending on how common this is. No HDL is also involved. This is a
one interesting situation. Low HDL without triglycerides is a risk.
It's called the A1 Milano. A group of people on the Lago di Garda, the Garda Lake, in northern Italy.
All the way from,
they have all been traced back to one person who has a mutation in the gene encoding in LPA1, which makes LPA1 more efficient in the cholesterol transport. So these people have no HDL and have no risk of cardiovascular risk. And this is an interesting fact point. Studies that fused people with recombinant particles where they made ApoA1 Milano associated with phospholipid bilayers and infused it into people and shown that you can reduce intermediate thickening in patients in 10 infusions once a week, once a week infused for 10 weeks, and they showed a reduction in plaques, intermediate thickness. That's pretty impressive. Of course, it's a very invasive kind of thing.
Anyhow, so there's some triglyceride disorders, and some of them are associated, some of them are, and some of them are not associated with this risk. And the ones that are is familial combined hyperlipidemia, I told you about 1 in 100 frequency. Remnant removal disease, very rare. Central obesity, very common, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, nephrotic syndrome, hypothyroidism, Cushing's. So a lot of things have this, but they have a combination of elevated triglycerides and decreased HDL. And the question is, which one is not causing the increased risk is not totally resolved.
Whenever you have elevated triglycerides, you get lowering of HDL. Because of the CETP protein, you get shot in. There's more triglycerides, you get more shot and LDL goes down.
And there are some hypertriglyceridemia patients that don't have increased cardiovascular risk, as far as we can tell. Familial chylomicronemia that I talked about. Estrogen, well, there's a question about estrogen now, of course. Alcohol raises HDL and is actually protective. People with moderate alcohol have a decreased risk of cardiovascular disease. It's one of the good things of alcohol. Bile acid resins will raise triglycerides, but that's, they lower HDL and therefore offset. With high carbohydrate diet, you can get some decrease in HDL, not necessarily increased still the concept of Ashkenazis. This small, dense LDL metabolic syndrome. You heard about this, but just briefly. This syndrome is something that is seen with central obesity. It's not shown here. Atherogenic dyslipidemia is the main problem, but they have increased blood pressure, they have insulin resistance, they have a procoagulant state, of course they have central obesity. They have low HDL. So they have low HDL, they have increased VLDL, IL, increased triglycerides, they have, may or may not have increased LDL. These are some of the factors that play a role, and all this can lead, of course, to atherosclerosis. If there's diabetes present, so hypertriglyceridemia leads to small dense LDL, kind of micro remnant accumulation, VLDL remnant accumulation, IDL, and decreased HDL. So, what is small dense LDL? Small dense LDL is LDL that gets depleted of cholesterol esters. And also, so both by lipoprotein lipase and hepatic lipase, you get rid of triglycerides, and if the LDL that escapes the uptake by the liver, then it circulates for a long time, can shrink down by activation of these enzymes and become a small, dense particle. The problem with that is that small, dense particle is considered pathogenic. So if you get a lipid profile, these patients have mildly elevated triglycerides. They have LDL calculated is not that elevated, and have low HDL. And you see that combination. You should think about small dense LDL. Now, how can you prove that somebody has small dense LDL? You can measure ApoB. ApoB is one ApoB molecule for each LDL molecule. So, if the ApoB is increased, but the cholesterol is not, then you know they have small dense LDL. Okay? Some patients where they have low HDL, triglycerides, total cholesterol elevated, they may benefit from statin therapy by lowering the number of LDL molecules. So this is significant low cholesterol content on LDL particles, increased number of LDL associated with increased level of triglyceride variable, LDL cholesterol, and decreased level of HDL. So it's a marker for the risk of liver disease, plus a mechanism of pathogenicity, greater uptake, it's more presumably increased uptake by macrophages, increased oxidation susceptibility. So that's a concept that is emerging as probably keep in mind. What do you think about atherogenic polyols? All the ones that have ApoB, because they can convert them. So those are remnants, IDL, so you use a C that is called IDL, it doesn't matter. So even VLDL is atherogenic, because it is a precursor to these. So whatever contains ApoB is potentially atherogenic. That's the way I think. HDL cholesterol is an assessment abnormal lipid profile. Look at the measured levels, measured things, the total cholesterol and our triglycerides and our HDL. Because HDL gets precipitated down, you can measure cholesterol dissipated, and the difference between what's getting precipitated by a thin black hole and the total is what's is HDL constant. So that's pretty robust measurements, and from this side's the measure, but from this side's the variable. You eat, from this side's go up, because you accumulate the higher microns. So if you use this calculation, just take the total cholesterol and subtract the HDL, you have non-HDL cholesterol. And that correlates with the cholesterol as well as the HDL. Target is 30 milligrams per deciliter higher than your LDL target. So if you say LDL is less than 100, then your patient should be less than 100 based on his risk profile, non-HDL cholesterol should be less than 1/3. It's very easy. You can do the calculations by looking at it. And number two, the important part is you can even use a non-fasting glucose. And if I look at the profiles in the clinic, about 50% of the lipid profiles are non-fasting. And they always calculate it. On the other hand, everybody looks at it. What's the problem with it? It's here. Take the total cholesterol, you have the non-HDL cholesterol, from that, subtract cholesterol by 5. This is based on the assumption that you only have VLDL cholesterol in the sample, because it's based on the assumption that it's a fasting specimen. In a fasting specimen, you have VLDL after overnight fast. If you have cholesterol, let's see here, see that this spike of VLDL has 100% cholesterol. So you can keep it 1/5. This is an empirical problem, but the correlates well with the truly measured. It's very difficult to measure LDL because you have to equilibrium or classification, the band corresponding to the density of LDL is possible clinically. So if you have microglycerins in addition to VLDL, then you have particles that have less than 20% cholesterol, only 5%. So you're getting a force in your LDL. This doesn't need it. That's why you say that. Underestimates atherogenic cholesterol, especially when it triglycerides. The triglycerides below 200, then you know there's not more significant.
So how can we use it that it's not
sorry, you just because you cannot use it for calculation of LDL, but you can still calculate the non-HDL cholesterol. Because it just and the total is not much affected by eating because chylomicrons only have 5% cholesterol. So they don't raise the total very much. That's why this is so much more useful. And they use it no matter what the triglycerides are. If it's above 400, it becomes totally unreliable. And sometimes if you look at the lipid profile, you see a minus level. They have a minus LDL, minus 50. Because it's like 5,000 triglycerides. So keep that in mind. This is really very, very important, I think. It's predictive, just in clinical trials, just as LDL. Use of triglycerides are greater than 100 allows NSAID guideline plus 30 mg/dL. Flexible allows use of non-fasting samples to assess that triglycerides. So what are we doing with time? Time is essentially, we know the metabolic syndrome, we know the what are the criteria, waist circumference, increased waist circumference, increased triglycerides, low HDL, and increased blood pressure. Fasting glucose, greater than 1 glucose for the overload. And some new features that are important now is those with diabetes also want to raise the level of coronaries equivalent for diabetes. Have as much cardiovascular risk as even if they don't have a previous cardiovascular event than those who have had previous vascular event and don't have diabetes. So there's a 2- to 4-fold increase in cardiovascular risk in diabetes, just by diabetes. Type 2.
having antennae of risk projections can be used to see multiple biological factors identified scanners. But that's a okay, that's important. In mind that it's not just another buffer.
You have to modify blood pressure, you have to modify
blood sugar, so weight, diet. I have some slides about it.
You're running out of time.
Maybe I'll bring them in the second lecture when I talk about therapy and end the lecture here. Okay. Questions? In 2 weeks I will go over the data on treatment. Yeah. LDL that you see is the calculated LDL by that formula. Yes. Okay. Let's see. I open as myself.
Oh, you don't belong to
I don't on my own, so.
Oh, okay, so maybe I'll get the.
I can
send oh, you can email. Yeah.
Send me an email and I'll respond.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.